It is the new frontier in the battle against depression, anxiety, addiction, and PTSD. Psychedelic drugs like magic mushrooms, ketamine, ecstasy, and LSD. The science behind the therapy is turning heads and gaining steam. Top universities, even Wall Street, are getting in on the game. So, can these drugs help you? And can they change the country? A special edition of Banfield is now. How was your day today? If you're like most Americans, something or someone probably set you off. If you're like many Americans, your day was a bummer. But if you are like one-fifth of the country, your day was clinically awful. That's because 21% of us suffer from depression, anxiety, addiction, or PTSD. Americans spend a staggering $240 billion per year on mental health services. But if what you're doing isn't working, or if you're looking for a better option, a better day, tonight might just be your night. Because a whole new field of psychiatric science is opening up to help Americans amid a mental health crisis and an opioid epidemic. Hold on to your hat. Because the science involves drugs like LSD, ecstasy, magic mushrooms, and ketamine, to name just a few. We are a really, really long way from the days of turn on, tune in, and drop out, the words of Timothy Leary. Science and the government are getting real about psychedelic therapy. Just ask Dr. Rick Doblin. He's the man who is at the forefront of the new treatments, and he's also the founder of the organization called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Dr. Doblin, so glad to have you on the program. Let me just start with the over-sweeping sort of question, and that is, what can psychedelics do for these mental illnesses that conventional drugs like Prozac and benzos and all those other things maybe haven't been doing?
Psychedelic drugs, when combined with therapy, can get people to address the roots of their emotional issues and can be curative, whereas the drugs that are typically available by prescription from psychiatrists are meant to be taken daily and are more about controlling symptoms. And so what
are you actually saying that we can cure these mental illnesses rather than just be on a treatment of drugs for the rest of our lives?
Yes, that's right. Although I don't want to leave the impression that, you know, once somebody has gotten over anxiety or depression or PTSD, that they'll never be anxious or depressed or have PTSD again in the rest of their lives, because, you know, life keeps throwing people curveballs and it's difficult and challenging. But yes, what our goal is to address the fundamental problems so they're addressed and that people don't continue to need new drugs or new psychotherapy.
So as I started looking into this, I thought all of them were illegal, but no, ketamine is not illegal. And there are therapeutic clinics that have popped up all around the country where when you're assisted with therapists, you can actually do these therapies. And what I've heard about ketamine is that it maybe doesn't last as long as, say, the MDMA treatments, which I believe are in, you know, phase three trials, as well as the LSD and magic mushrooms therapy. Can you sort that out for me and tell me where we're at with all of that?
Yeah, ketamine is what's called a dissociative anesthetic. It's on the United Nations list of essential medicines. It's been around since the 60s, and it's very effective as a anesthetic drug. But in roughly one-tenth the anesthetic dose, it can be psychedelic. And Johnson & Johnson has demonstrated that S-ketamine, an isomer, a branch, sort of, you could say, of ketamine, was effective in suicidal depression. So it is legal. There's about 300 clinics now around the country that are administering ketamine. Most of them, I think, are not doing it in an optimal way in the sense that they're treating it as a pharmacological treatment without psychotherapy. But more and more people are starting to understand that if you add psychotherapy, it'll work better and last longer. And it's different than LSD or psilocybin or MDMA in that the fact that ketamine is this dissociative anesthetic in the sense it takes you out of yourself, but it in a way helps you reset your brain. But the LSD, the psilocybin from the magic mushrooms, MDMA, brings you into your experiences, and then you work through them emotionally by releasing the memories and the feelings and the body sensations.
So, and as I did some further research, I actually did a documentary for PBS called The Brain Revolution, in which we discussed the neuroplasticity of the brain. And I'll just boil that down into really layman's terms. But you can kind of remap. It's plasticine almost. You can remap certain things in your brain. And is that effectively the very simple explanation of what psychedelics combined with psychotherapy can do for you? It can remap the problem places in your brain that are causing the mental illness?
Yeah, that's a good way to understand it. Because what you're doing is you're developing new neural connections, and you're routing memories through your brain in a different way. Previous traumatic memories are now what's called fear extinction and memory reconsolidation, and that you're strengthening parts of your brain that can be pro-social, or that love and feeling of connection and belonging and attachment. So I think it's hard for people to understand, how can you have a few experiences encased by psychotherapy that can change the rest of your life? And I think the neuroplasticity that you're talking about is the way for people to help them understand that you are rewiring your brain in new ways.
It's astounding to read the list of things that can actually, you know, benefit, you know, from these psychotherapies. Autism, anorexia, terminally ill depressions that's self-explanatory. The opioid issues, you know, like severe addictions, that these, it's ironic that you can use a psychedelic to cure a drug addiction. But I am interested to sort of explore the issue of the safe setting, because it's not like you should just drop LSD and go partying at a club and expect you're going to cure yourself. The safe setting is key here, isn't it?
Yeah, the set and setting. Actually, Timothy Leary first started talking about that that's really important for having the best outcomes. I wouldn't say that it's ironic, though, that psychedelics can be used for the treatment of substance abuse, because Bill Wilson, Bill W., the founder of AA, his first experience getting sober was on belladonna, that's a psychedelic drug. And then in the 50s, he did LSD, and he felt that LSD could be very helpful and have a role to play in AA, but it got to be a bit too controversial. But we're basically returning to those roots. And so I think psychedelics, by helping people look at what's been difficult for them, by helping them resolve it, and then helping them have a feeling of connection and spirituality, that you can understand how psychedelics can be helpful in the treatment of substance abuse.
So, you know, back in the 60s, things got a bit crazy. You know, the whole counterculture argument, the hippies are doing it, we got to outlaw this stuff, that lasted a really long time. And so the big question I have now is that these drugs, you know, particularly MDMA, are in, you know, phase 3 trials. When might we actually see this stuff coming to market in a mainstream kind of way? If people are watching right now, they might be saying, well, I want to do this. When might they be able to?
Well, we're anticipating, we've completed our first phase 3 study, and which was very successful. Our second one will be done at the, we think, in October of 2022. And we think before the end of 2023, we'll have FDA approval for the prescription use of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD. We think that psilocybin for anxiety and depression will be about 1 year behind by the end of 2024. And we think by the end of 2024, we'll have MDMA for PTSD approved in Europe, and then we will go around the world to get it approved elsewhere.
Is there a risk, Dr. Doblin, of moving too fast? Because, you know, too much of a good thing can have blowback. And some people might just say, I'm sorry, you're talking about LSD? Not a chance, not on my watch. Is that a risk?
Well, there's a risk of going forward without the proper data that we need for FDA and other regulatory agencies. But this is not too fast. These drugs and their therapeutic potential were well known in the 60s. There was a lot of good studies. And as you say, there was a reaction for political reasons to block it. But we have known for over 50 years the potential of these drugs. MDMA was used therapeutically in the late 70s. And then it escaped from those settings, became ecstasy, and then it got criminalized in 1985. So I'd say the only risk is that we need to work at the speed that the regulators are willing to work at. We need to generate the data on safety and efficacy. But once the regulators are ready to say, yes, you've proved safety and efficacy, then we should move forward as quickly as possible, because there's also a risk of moving too slowly. When we think about the number of people that are committing suicide, that are suffering,
so there's
risks on all different sides.
Dr. Joblin, I can't thank you enough for this information, and thank you for coming on the program. And I want to let our viewers know, coming up, if you've ever, you know, stayed in a Kimpton hotel, you're going to know my next guest, because she's now using that Kimpton name to fund research in psychedelics. Welcome back to the show. It is a lot to take in. I mean, just that list alone, LSD, ketamine, MDMA, psilocybin. What exactly do they all do? And if you're a patient, what does it feel like? Well, you can ask Laura Kimpton. She's not just a patient. She's also an advocate and a major donor in this new frontier of psychiatric medicine. Welcome, Laura. It's nice to see you.
Thank you so much for having me. This is my passion.
Well, and I'm glad that you're my guest, because I think that you know a lot about this because you've lived it. So give me the background on how you came into being a part of this whole frontier.
Well, first, my father died 20 years ago. He started Kimpton Hotels, and he left a foundation where 50% of the means need to go to solve depression, PTSD, trauma, and alternative means. So we spent the last 20 years researching that. And so we were doing meditation, yoga, food. My dad was working with scanning the brains of the monks. And I always knew that I was someone who suffered from severe PTSD from child abuse. And I must say it's from non-parent child abuse. And so I was always researching and looking for ways to not be put on medication, especially after my daughter was born. Because I'm in theory that there's a big theory that you have to process what happened to you at the age of your child. So I went looking and researching how to do this. And the funny story is, and tell me when you want me to stop and ask another question, but the funny story is I was out of Burning Man 2004. I was a new burner. I had just built an art car, not the 15 pieces you'll see. And I was out, way out at the fence. And Burning Man's a 30-mile by 10-mile lake bed. So and they fence off 6 miles by 6 miles. So you can go to nowhere. And we had driven our art car out, and I was playing croquet. And it was a croquet for a giant. So the balls were 6 feet tall, and you had to take six people with the mallets. And I was on psilocybin mushrooms, and I was having a ball. Laughing. And as I walked about the 300 feet back to my art car, I looked down at myself, and because of the playa dust, made my legs look like they were covered in bruises. And excuse me. And so I fell to my knees and cried about my suffering from child abuse, and all I could see was bruises. And after crying about 20 minutes, I saw a piece of moot, we call it in Burning Man. It's a paper, something that should be thrown away, go by me. And I ran. And it took me about 10 minutes. My husband laughed because it was the time. He never saw me run so far fast. And I put my foot on the piece of paper, and it was a brochure from MAPS saying, use psychedelics to get over childhood trauma. And that's how it started.
Wow, that coincidence is remarkable. And so just to sort of... And I should say, you know, MAPS, obviously the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, the processes that you've been through are myriad. You correct me if I'm wrong, you're on a prescription for ketamine, which I think you take twice a week as well. You see a psychiatrist every month. You have also, I think you do the psilocybin therapy as well, not frequently. That's the magic mushroom therapy. LSD twice a year, and MDMA about 4 to 6 times a year. Do you find that these have a profound effect each time you do them? And do you feel that you're going to need to continue doing them? Or do you feel like you're repairing?
So they're all very different. So the MDMA I used with a therapist first, and that's what you usually do, and that's what MAPS is working with. And what the MDMA does, and why I still do it four times a year, usually now at a concert, but what it does for me, when you're someone who is a survivor of child abuse since before memory, you live in fight or flight all the time. Like Robert Sapolsky, he's a great writer. He writes about explaining what physical problems you'll have if you live in fight or flight. And I have all those problems. And what MDMA did for me the first time I ever took it, which was interesting, was at the marijuana policy project, because my family's been very involved in getting marijuana become legal, was it took away my fight or flight. I instantaneously was in a room with people and just being. And that had never happened to me before. I've always was, when you're someone from abuse, you overfire your brain. And I have a master's in psychology, so I can tell you that I've studied this so much. You overfire, and you're constantly firing to the most dangerous person in the room because you need to know for your safety. And that's a dangerous thing to do because of energy. You're pulling that person towards you. And so what MDMA taught me, and over the 20 years that I've been experiencing it, has taught me how to be in the room without being codependent or looking for dangerous people in the room.
Hmm. Okay, so and you mentioned that your family is Kimpton Hotels. I mean, that's just massive. It's such a big deal.
Lucky I was Bill Kimpton's daughter.
are you ever? And that has also allowed you to be a major donor to this emerging science, like to the tune of millions, which is wow. I mean, holy Moses. So I guess, and I only have a minute or so left, but I wanted to get your feeling on whether you think that we are at the cusp of mainstream approach to this kind of therapy, to psychedelic therapy.
So what it happens is, so I ended up finding, and I want to make sure I get ketamine in there, is why ketamine, and I have a prescription for ketamine, different than having for mushrooms like LSD or MDMA, is because what ketamine does is so my last session, I was very sad and depressed over the fact that I can't get a vaccination because I have too many antibodies. So that means I can't go out. And it was hitting my rejection issues. And so I go into ketamine, and it's a prescription I put under my mouth. And for the hour I'm there, all it does is it kind of makes a cashmere energy around my overfiring and makes me realize that maybe I'm just terrified. I'm not depressed. So what we're working with, and MAPS is working with, and the Ketamine Research Foundation is working with, is and we mainly test on vets. So a vet can come home with PTSD and they get put on an antidepressant, and that goes on forever and has side effects and all these other things. With ketamine and MDMA, you work with a therapist three times and you pretty much are back. The reason I still do it two times a week is it really helps me with going out into the world to not have an issue with my overfiring. Some people it's three times and it's over. But
that's
what's
so incredible.
Zero.
You know, that's what's so remarkable is that so many people like you have said it's one and done, or one, two, and three and done, not lifetime of prescriptions. Laura Kimpton, thank you so much for sharing your story.
So
I really
much.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
It's good to meet you.
Yes,
thank you. And when we come back, go ahead.
I'm just saying, if there are people out there that know people are suffering, please research these ketamine clinics and the MDMA soon to happen.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And we're actually going to do a little bit more coverage on that as we go forward, because when we come back, how one woman said that LSD saved her marriage and her relationship with her kids and actually saved her life. The science of microdosing and also the controversies behind it. Next. Ayelet Waldman is an accomplished writer. She's a former public defender, and she's a Harvard Law School grad, same class as President Obama. She's written several books, among them, A Really Good Day, how microdosing made a mega difference in my mood, my marriage, and my life. And Ayelet Waldman joins me now. It's good to meet you. I read a New York Times piece about your experience with microdosing LSD and how it completely changed your life, your world, your family. I wanted to sort of dig back into that time that you did that and ask you if things are better now since you went through a treatment of microdosing LSD, or if you need to go back to it.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that if the treatment were legal, that I would, in fact, be using it as a prescribed medication. I stopped using it because it is not legal, and I was willing to commit a crime for about a month, but not an extended period. Microdosing, unlike larger doses of psychedelics, is not linked to a kind of permanent change in outlook, a kind of permanent change in mood. It's probably more akin to something like ketamine, which has a short-term effect. So if you're not actually microdosing, you're not going to experience the positive outcomes. However, larger doses of psychedelics, psychedelic drugs like psilocybin, which is, you know, people think of that as magic mushrooms, or LSD, have actually been linked to long-term improvement in mood.
So then the frustrating thing must have been for you that the microdosing month was great and life, you know, really just the sun opened up and your husband, your kids, your job, your writing, your clarity, just everything improved and you weren't high, but you couldn't keep going with that. What did you do afterwards?
So, and I think the most important thing to understand is that when I started the experiment, I was profoundly depressed. I was suicidal. I was anhedonic. I was in a very dark place, the darkest of my life. And what the microdosing did was it allowed me to, it alleviated my depression right away. It allowed me to access the beneficial elements of cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, which was really, I think that's what improved my mood in the long term more than anything else. It improved my relationship with my kids and with my husband. In fact, so much that one morning, my daughter, who was then in middle school, I was up making her pancakes, singing a song, not like me. Usually I'm miserable in the morning. And she looked at me and she said, "What is wrong with you? Are you on acid?"
And she didn't know. I mean, this was kind of like out of the blue, a coincidence that she would. Did you say yes?
I didn't say it then, but eventually, you know, I was writing a book about it, so I had to tell them. So eventually I sat them down and I explained. At the time, I just said I was trying a new medication, which they were used to. You know, my kids were experienced with me going on various different medications and trying new things to try to deal with my mood disorder. So that part of it was familiar to them. My older kids, however, knew that I was trying psychedelic drugs. They were supportive of the experiment. I mean, anything to, you know, when someone you love is unhappy, when someone you love can't kind of move beyond her own misery, you want them to get better no matter what it takes.
So as I understood it, the way you got a hold of it, because again, it's not legal, so you can't get it unless you can find it. And there was a researcher who had said, listen, I'm not going to be using the end of this supply. I'll give it to you. I think that the problems that you've had with your mental health, maybe this would work for you. And that's how you got the supply. But once that brown paper bag, you know, was done, have you had to go back to the original medications that you had been on before and didn't love?
Well, I'll tell you, that's not quite how I got it. What happened was I was consulting with a researcher, but nobody provides drugs because that's a crime, that's stealing. So I started sort of asking around, you know, trying to find people in Berkeley. I thought it would be so easy that, you know, LSD would rain down on my head like orange sunshine. I live in the psychedelic capital of the world. Couldn't find it. And I was very obvious in my search. And then I had heard about maybe there was an older an quite elderly psychedelic psychonaut in Berkeley who was sort of reaching the end of his life and maybe had some extra supply, but I could never track that person down. And then one day, a package arrived in the mail, and the return address was Lewis Carroll. And in the package, a little bottle that basically said, drink me. And of course, I tested it. I'm not crazy. I don't drink stuff that arrives in the mail, but I tested it. It was LSD. So I tried it, and it wasn't a full dose. It was it was set up in microdoses. You know, two drops would be the 10 micrograms that I felt comfortable using as a microdose. A regular dose is about 100 micrograms. Since that time, I never went back on the SSRIs that were prescribed to me because those did not work for me. In fact, those were, if the doctor had said to me, hey, I'm going to prescribe you a drug that's going to make you fat and lose your sex drive, and maybe might make you feel a little better some of the time, that would have been a more accurate description of what SSRIs would do for me than what you know we typically hear on the advertisements. But I am on a medication now that's not an SSRI. It's Lamictal, and it's working quite well for me.
But if you had the opportunity, if LSD microdosing and that kind of therapy were legalized, would you shift right back to it?
I think so, because now look, there is no way for me to know if what I experienced was a placebo effect, because after all, the placebo effect is very powerful. And while we know we have good research that shows that that the results of large doses or sort of typical doses of psilocybin and LSD are not placebo, that they are linked to increase in to improvement in mood, decrease in depression. We don't have the same research about microdosing. So I want to be very clear that it's very possible that what I experienced is a placebo effect. And in fact, you know, we've been hearing about some research that doesn't seem to show good results on microdosing. So, that being said, I think if it were legal, I would probably try it again because it did work for me, and placebo or no placebo, it was very effective. And I think I would also try other things. Like, for example, I would try a moderate dose taken, say, every few months, a dose that allowed me to experience the kind of insight and the dissolution of ego that seems to be what is effective in treating depression in terms of the larger doses of psilocybin and LSD.
And you know, the chance for maybe some of the neuroplasticity issues to kick in as well. Ayala, thank you so much for your time and for opening up and talking with us about your story, especially as a former public defender. It's very brave. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, I want to talk a little bit about vets, because I know you know that a lot of vets are suffering gravely having come back from war, many of them with PTSD. Navy SEALs, definitely not the kind of people you expect to just go out there and ask for help, right? But you're about to meet a Navy SEAL who did, and he found that help in psychedelics and now wants to help a lot of other people and not just SEALs. That's coming up.
When I was walking out the door, I remember saying, don't think I'm going to come back after this weekend like a new person, because that's crazy. And man, was I wrong.
Capone knew that it was more than just PTSD, that her husband Marcus, a former Navy SEAL and explosives expert, was dealing with. And she was right. He was dealing with a lot as a vet coming back from having been in combat. And you have heard the stories about so many others like him. But what is there for them that is mainstream, that's working? And what is not mainstream that's working? The Capones are joining me now, along with Dr. Lynette Avril, one of the country's leading clinical psychologists on psychedelics research. Welcome to all three of you. And Marcus, I'll just start with you. you were suffering gravely with afflictions that likely came from your work in the war zone, and you chose to really break out into the frontier and go for psychedelic therapy. Tell me a little bit about the journey and whether it worked for you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having us. I explored every other option. I did what I was supposed to do. I started going to brain clinics while I was still on active duty. And, I thought that, I never thought that I was getting any answers. I think they were, they're always telling you that you have something that is wrong with your brain, but I never felt like there was a real fix to it. So I really felt, it was a real Western medicine approach to fixing your problem, which is, we'll put a Band-Aid on it and hope it doesn't bleed again. And it never got to the root cause. I started SSRIs while I was still active duty. I was also put on, Adderall and Ambien and a host of other things. I think we just recently found out I was on 10 at one time. But nothing seemed to work, and I was really getting frustrated. I'd been to my fifth brain clinic. I believe I saw my first psychologist in 2007 or 2008, and I can't tell you how many I saw after that. But it all, went back to the same. The problem wasn't being solved. And I was really starting to spiral as soon as my transition in 2013, 14, 15, 16 got really bad. I want to say when you're hopeless or when you've really exhausted all the help that the experts say that you need, you'll really try anything. Lucky for me, Amber was working in the background along with a doctor and some friends, and found relief through psychedelic treatment. For me, this was, this was crazy. I never, I never did a drug. I, listened to what we were told in the, in the 80s and 90s, the war on drugs. And, so for me, this was a big leap, and it took me about a year to commit. I didn't want to hear that, these things worked, because again, I just thought it was, absolutely insane that you can take a psychedelic and supposedly it was going to heal some or all your problems. The more research I did, the more it started to make sense, because everything I was reading were from, medical professionals that were a lot smarter than I was. And so I took a leap of faith. 2017 just happened to be Veterans Day. I went to a retreat that provided a medicine called Ibogaine, which is extracted from the Iboga plant. Radically changed my life. I don't know. We could talk more about it, but such a profound experience. My first thing I wanted to do was just help others. And I turned to Amber and I said, more people need to know about this. I couldn't believe that there weren't more veterans that had been through this treatment. I just figured, I must have been the 100th or the 1,000th when I learned that there was really only one other that I knew. We had to get to work. And so Amber and I kind of just, rolled up our sleeves. We joke about it, put it together with glue and tape, and started raising money and built the nonprofit that we have today.
So Amber, I want to turn to you on this, because, a lot of people have the same story as Marcus, and they say, this was like a miracle. I completely transformed. I was on, and I'll just read some of the list. Prozac, Abilify, Celexa, Lexapro, Paxil, Seroquel, Zoloft. That's only a short list for depression, and I haven't even hit the anxiety ones yet. And that all of a sudden, one or two treatments with a psychedelic, and there was no need for additional treatment. Is that the case with Marcus? That it was almost like one and done, or does he have to be, in a treatment regimen going forward?
It was far, far more effective than anything had been to that point. And although it's not a one size fits all or a one and done for many, it can create such profound healing in such a short amount of time that it just covers more ground than anything else that's currently available. And the therapies are really compelling for various areas of veteran suffering, whether it's trauma, or physiological conditions like traumatic brain injury or addiction. There's these therapies are wildly effective.
Well, when we come back after the break, I want to talk a little bit about the stigma and how that seems to be going away with some very prominent Republicans and even a former Republican governor who have stepped in to say, wait a minute now, this actually might be worth something. So we're going to talk about that in a moment.
Example of a fairly conservative elected official who is against drugs in any form or fashion. These compounds are different than no other compound that we would have in our arsenal, if you will. Used properly, it can save lives.
So that's the former Texas Republican Governor Rick Perry saying, hey, you know, maybe there's something to psilocybins and some of this kind of therapy. So with that, Dr. Lynette Avril, I'd like to ask you, what are the chances now that business has moved in, Wall Street has moved in, $2 billion roughly as of a couple of years ago had been invested in this particular frontier, the psychedelic therapy frontier. What are the chances that we might actually see something a little earlier than what I hear, which is 2023 for legalizing MDMA therapy and 2024 for legalizing psilocybin therapy?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think there's definitely potential there. I think there is incredible positive momentum right now and an incredible amount of interest in psilocybin and MDMA, especially as well as other psychedelic medicines. I think, you know, of course, research sometimes is a bit of a slow moving beast. And there are really good reasons for that. You know, of course, we want to have a sizable body of evidence that suggests these interventions are safe and effective and, you know, that we really understand that they are working. I would imagine because they have FDA, you know, breakthrough status, because there is so much momentum, because so many states are, you know, being very interested in pushing forward various legislation to support these interventions, I could imagine that there may be a bit of a fast track beyond, you know, the as you said, estimated 2023 and 2025.
That can also be a blessing and a curse too, right? Because if the commercialization goes too quickly and there's a backlash, you know, a lot of researchers, and I'm sure you're one of them, are worried that you'll be set back in this movement because this has been an uphill battle against the stigma of these kinds of drugs. The governor even said it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, certainly I think the Capones, myself, and many, many others in this space are very aware that we need to be very thoughtful, very rational, and very cautious in the way that this entire movement, this entire renaissance, if you will, of psychedelic medicine goes forward. I think as with most things, if we sort of rush headlong, you know, in without really knowing where we're going and having a plan, both for, you know, considering accessibility, considering how we're actually going to roll these out, scalability, the commercialization aspect. Also, of course, psychedelics. You know, many of these are plant-based medicines with millennia of kind of cultural background and things that I think is also a critical piece that we need to be attentive to as these gain momentum.
So, Amber, let me just ask you, because I know you've just done so much reading on this and obviously started the foundation because of your commitment to it. And I just have a minute left, but I just want you to tell me, Is this the kind of thing that is going to be a success because it is a permanent fix to many of these ailments, or is it just because it's a good thing to do and it can help no matter what?
Well, I would defer to science for that. I would say that our family has experienced that this is the beginning of an entirely new potential for the rest of Marcus's life. And like many post 9/11 veterans, if you were prime fighting age on 9/11, you still have half of your life left to live. And I prefer that my husband lives that to his fullest and that he's not overly medicated. This completely stopped the bleeding for us and has given him an opportunity to now live a thriving and successful, happy, fulfilled life. And I feel like any veteran can have that. They shouldn't just be surviving. They should be.
No, you're right. Yep. And you know what? It's good to see Marcus. It's good to see you smiling. And I'm glad that you're here with us. And I'd like to say thank you for your service as well. But I appreciate all three of you showing up tonight and helping us out, Marcus, Amber, and Dr. Avril. And thank you all, everyone, for watching. I encourage you to do a little of your own research as well. This is certainly a story that continues. I got strength, potential energy.